Good afternoon and welcome to Open Air, KLW's weekly radio magazine of the performing arts. I'm your host, David LaTulipe. Today I'll be talking with conductor Ben Simon and Grammy Award-winning violinist Evan Price about the San Francisco Chamber Orchestra's upcoming concerts. You'll hear about Central Works production of Into the Beautiful North by Karen Zacharias with three of the actors involved. Plus you'll hear about celebratory events surrounding ODC at 40. And contributor Peter Robinson recommends some reading material for your next flight and where to find those books at the airport. Stay with us. Central Works in Berkeley concludes its 2016 season with Into the Beautiful North, a new play by Karen Zacharias, which runs through November 13th at the historic Berkeley City Club on Durant Avenue in Berkeley. Into the Beautiful North is based on the novel by Pulitzer Prize finalist Luis Alberto Urrea and inspired by the classic Hollywood Western, The Magnificent Seven. I'm joined by three of the cast members who play multiple roles in the production. Caleb Cabrera, who returns to Central Works for a second time this season, having appeared in the season opener, Totem and Taboo. He's a part of the ensemble and Shotgun Players 25th anniversary season as well, and received a BA in SF from SFSU in theater arts. Welcome to you, Caleb.
Hi, thank you.
Sure. Also, Samantha Unin
Kubius.
Thank you for help with that. Samantha, she's a graduate of UC Berkeley, where she performed in many of the main stage productions for the theater department there. She currently works on the staff at the Berkeley Rep Theater and also manages to get on stage here for Central Works. Welcome to you, Samantha.
Thank you.
And veteran actor Rudy Guerrero, I've seen several times in productions at 42nd Street Moon. He's also been performing at ACT, Berkeley Rep, Connecticut Rep Theater, as well as Foothill Music Theater, as he won the Bay Area Theater Critics Circle Award for his principal performance as the leading player in Pippin. He also joins me in studio. Rudy, welcome to you.
Glad to be here.
Well, this play has been called a sort of Monty Python and the Holy Grail meet a taco joint and relocates to where there may soon be a wall. So who wants to take a stab at a nutshell synopsis of the play?
Sure. So as you mentioned, it very much follows the storyline of The Magnificent Seven. It's about three friends who are from a small town in Mexico, Tres Camarones. And in this case, the bandits are narcos, so drug dealers who come and threaten the safety of their town. And to protect their town, they decide to take a journey north, so across the border. And hilarity ensues after that, but it's very much about the journey to find these warriors who will defend their town.
Well, it's a very timely production, and Karen Zacharias is known for using some contemporary ideas to weave into her works. Did anybody know Karen's work before this play?
I wasn't actually familiar with Karen's work, no, but yeah.
Neither was I.
It was a great introduction, though.
So it's all new for you. That's great.
Yes, it is.
And presenting this as a premiere, and it's called a rolling premiere, a rolling world premiere. Someone explain what that actually means.
Sure, I will.
Sure.
This is Central Works' first rolling world premiere, and they are part of the National New Play Network. And what the rolling world premiere addresses is primarily two issues facing small theaters in America today. One is that small theaters are constantly in competition with big theaters to get their hands on new plays. Secondly, new plays by playwrights often have difficulty getting a second production because no theater wants to do the second production of a premiere. So what the Rolling World Premiere does, in this case, Central Works is the second theater of four that are producing Into the Beautiful North within the span of a year. It first premiered at the Milagro Theater in Portland, Oregon, then here at Central Works in Berkeley. After this, it goes to San Diego Repertory Theater, And then after that, it goes to
Chicago.
A theater outside of Chicago.
16th Street.
Right. There we go.
All right.
Yeah.
Teamwork. I like
that.
Yeah.
That's how we work.
So I mentioned that this is rooted in reality. The reality is this town has been basically decimated of its male population.
Right. Mm-hmm.
For reasons that people do migrate north. Rudy, since we had you on, you play multiple characters in this. Why don't you explain what you're... Caleb. All right.
Actually, I just play one character.
All right.
Caleb plays multiple characters.
Caleb, so, multiple characters. Talk to us about
that. Well, I've got a little lucky because I only play four characters. There's some other actors that are playing six, seven, eight.
Oh, my gosh.
And so for me, I play the narco. I play Captain Jack Sparrow. I play a man on the street, and then I play Atomico. So you've got these, you know, it's a lot of fun getting to play a bunch of different characters, but what I really enjoy is that it's a fictional town and that here are all, and there's no men because they've all gone north to find work. And what this book and this play explores is not only what it means for these people to go north, but also what home means for them when they are north.
Mm-hmm.
And that's sort of what it becomes all about, is how much they want to get back. And it's really quite heartwarming,
mm-hmm.
Get an opportunity to play all these different characters. And some of them only have one line. Some have just a few lines, and then some have even more than that. So it's a lot of quick changes.
And director Gary Graves must have helped you sort through that transitions.
Yeah. He gave us outlines for each one. We also came in with our own ideas, and we just, through working together and sort of bouncing off of each other, we just solidified all these just unique individuals.
Rudy, what's your character then?
Okay, well,
single character.
I play the character Tacho. He is the taco master of the local restaurant in Tres Camarones called La Mano Caída, which in English means limp wrist. And he's openly gay and he's pretty much in your face about it, which is why he names his restaurant that. He's also sort of he's Nayeli, who's the protagonist in the show played by Samantha.
Yeah.
He's her boss, but also her good friend and sort of older brother figure as well. And he joins her on her quest north to find these seven magnificent men to bring back and protect Tres Camarones.
So let's dwell on that for a little bit, based on, you know, inspired by the Magnificent Seven. So remind people of what that was all about.
Who's the Magnificent Seven expert here?
I don't think any of us.
I know that there are a ton of Yul Brynner references and Steve McQueen references throughout.
It's a classic Western based on Kurosawa's film, The Seven Samurai.
Right.
They're basically recruiting people to help retrieve,
right. The tagline
save
is,
their town. So
seven magnificent Mexican men. To come back and save the town.
I think the interesting thing about the play and where it sort of removes itself from the film is that I feel like those films were very much about men and the seven magnificent men. And I think throughout the course of the play, the characters that really shine throughout are the women. And not just because Nayeli is the principal role, but you have a lot of really great secondary characters like Tia Irma, Nayeli's aunt, who, you know, provides counsel to the girls as they're making their way up north. Vampy, the different indigenous women that they meet on the way up north. So I think Karen has done a really great job about sort of shifting the focus of the story to, like, you know, we are the people looking for the heroes, and then throughout the course of the play we sort of realize we are the heroes, you know. So I like that.
Yeah, Samantha, tell us more about the roles that you play.
I'm just Nayeli.
Just Nayeli.
Yeah, just Nayeli. And it's something that I'm happy about. If you ever look outside of the theater in the hallway where everybody's doing their quick changes and transitions,
that's a show unto itself.
Yeah, exactly.
But I think Samantha's got like 3 pages of a break. She's on stage for most of the time.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So, yeah, it's pretty intense.
That's neat. So what is it like performing in this space, that the Berkeley City Club? I didn't realize that they have a proper theater space there. Or is it kind of transitioned?
It's definitely a very small space.
I think it's very intimate.
It's very intimate, right. Better word, intimate. And I think I've actually really enjoyed it because I'm a big fan of cramming a ton of people into small performing spaces. We've had to work out a lot of traffic jams, but I think also it's been really great to it's been really great to work with the challenge of telling this story in a place that wasn't originally a theater, you know, and being creative with the space that we have, you know, going out into the audience, sitting on the steps, you know, using the doors for comic effects. So, yeah.
Let's talk, we're tackling a pretty serious subject here, but there's obviously humor involved in it. And what are the scenes that you can give away that are particularly worth a belly laugh?
I think. Sorry, I don't want to monopolize.
No, please go ahead. Because
I tend to focus on
all the serious things that happen to Tacho. Oh,
okay. I think it's
we'll talk about that too.
It's a story about crossing the border. So, of course, there are interactions with the different members of the border patrol, both the Mexican Border Patrol and the United States Border Patrol.
And this is crossing the border in a proper way. Is that true or not?
No, not necessarily.
And that's actually something that is brought up through the course of the play. Like, I think you encounter different characters who have crossed both, or different characters who are both documented and undocumented and who have crossed in different ways, and sort of the conflicts that arise between those two group of people. Mm-hmm. That's something that I think on the more serious side, but I think also with characters like the Border Patrol officers, you get a sense of like, you know, who is it that they're willing to let pass through the border, you know, because of their own biases and whatnot. And it provides for some humor there, I think,
And you mentioned, Rudy, that there's more of a serious side that you encounter.
Yeah. My character, Tacho, goes through some pretty intense situations in trying to cross the border. I don't know how much I want to give away, but interesting enough, what it does in this very intimate space that Central Works has, the audience really has no choice but to become involved in the story. Mm-hmm. And I've heard from a number of audience members tell me how uncomfortable they felt at certain times witnessing what's happening to my character because it's literally at their feet.
Mm. Right.
Interesting. So after crossing the border, I understand there are several destinations that the group encounter along the way or end up along the way.
Yeah. So first we arrive. Well, they meet Atomico in the Dompe, which is the Tijuana dump. And that's where he resides. He was part of the Mexican army, and now he ran away. And that's where he lives. And he sort of willed this little character of his own, to this hero, into life. And so he jumps onto their journey. They make it to San Diego. From San Diego, they have to go to Kankakee, Illinois, to find Nayeli's father. And it's actually the three of us that make the journey to Kankakee, which, what is it?
Tell them who Atomico is based on.
Atomico is based off of, ever since he saw Yojimbo, his whole life just sort of changed. He starts a judo club in the barracks. He leaves the army. And he lives in the dump. He has a bamboo staff that he found and filled with glue and ball bearings to make it really lethal. Mm-hmm. He takes care of stray dogs, and he works in the dump, and so he is on board from the minute he meets them and is, becomes their protector.
It's a roadshow, you know, off on the road.
Yeah, he's like a Ronin.
Kankakee. So what happens without, you know, giving away the ending, what sort of resolution is reached in the play?
Sort of
I can call this a spoiler alert if we want, but
interesting. It brings up it sort of embraces a study that was done by the Pew Research Center in 2015, where they did the study over the course between 2009 and 2014, and they found that 140,000 more Mexicans returned to Mexico from the United States rather than coming to the United States from Mexico. So it's sort of flipping what's out there in the media right now. It's sort of debunking that more people are actually going back home. And that's what these characters discover, actually, is where home is. And the people that they find willing to come back also sort of come to that realization.
Right. Well, this is always a dangerous question to ask actors. And feel free to pass on it if you want. After Into the Beautiful North, what's coming up for you? Anyone want to share their upcoming plans?
I'll go first. Okay. I'm currently in rehearsals for the play Equus at Theater Rhinoceros. After that, I'm scheduled to do La Cage aux Folles at San Francisco Playhouse.
Nice, nice.
And I'm currently in negotiations for another show that I can't mention right now.
Okay, well, fair enough. Plans, acting or otherwise, we can.
So after we save Sinaloa, I'm gonna. I'm gonna go after Tres Camarones, gonna go back to Shotgun and finish out the rep season with Grand Concourse and continuing understudying Hamlet. And I have this sneaking feeling that as soon as we get into rep, some of the actors from Hamlet are gonna be calling on me to take their spot. So I might get some nights to go on as Laertes. Be a lot of fun.
Oh, cool! Yeah. Nice, nice. And Samantha, you're going to be working at Berkeley Rep as well.
Yeah, exactly. It's actually something that I strive to do. I think at least once a year, apart from working at a very large theater company, I try to do work in the smaller theater companies because I think it improves my work with Berkeley Rep. I think being involved in the community and being engaged with the community that I think we're servicing. So.
Nice.
Yeah.
Nice. Well, thank you for your work there. That's Samantha Cubillas, Caleb Cabrera also joining me, and Rudy Guerrero. Thanks for coming in today, guys. And I look forward to seeing Into the Beautiful North.
Thank you for having us.
Central Works closes its 2016 season with Into the Beautiful North by Karen Zacharias, based on the book by Luis Alberto Urrea. It's running through November 13th at the Berkeley City Club on Durant Avenue in Berkeley. For more information, go to Central Works' website, centralworks.org. Still to come, I'll be talking with Christy Bolingbroke about the ODC's 40th season of dance and events. I'll also have Peter Robinson comment on some ways to increase your intelligence quotient by finding a good book to read on your next air flight. And next, some music. So stay with us here on Open Air. Music of a neoclassical bent by Prokofiev, the Classical Symphony, and that was performed by the San Francisco Chamber Orchestra, highlights from their 2014-15 season. On the opening concert, there'll be music of Stravinsky's Pulcinella Suite, which, coupled with Pergolesi's Concerto for String Orchestra, the two-time Grammy Award winner and jazz violinist extraordinaire Evan Price takes the stage and jump-starts this 2016-17 season with his newly commissioned Concerto for Jazz, Violin, and Orchestra. A versatile and virtuosic performer, Evan has thrilled audiences around the world with such ensembles as the Turtle Island String Quartet, the Hot Club of San Francisco, and many others. Evan, welcome to Open Air.
Thank you. Good to be here.
The San Francisco Chamber Orchestra has been around since 1953 and is dedicated to making classical music accessible to audiences of all ages and backgrounds across the Bay Area by providing fully professional, admission-free concerts and educational programming. And since 2002, it's been led by native San Franciscan Ben Simon, who has performed for audiences around the world as a violist with the Naumburg Award-winning New World String Quartet, the Stanford String Quartet, as well as the Orpheus Chamber Orchestra, L.A., and New York Philharmonics as well. He's also led orchestras and contemporary ensembles around the United States and Europe, recorded film soundtracks, and has taught at Harvard and Stanford. It's a pleasure to welcome Ben back to our KALW open airwaves.
Thank you, David. Nice to be here.
So, Evan, tell me about this piece, the Concerto for Jazz, Violin, and Orchestra.
Well, to begin with, I'm so glad that it's finished. Because for quite a long time, it wasn't.
Me too.
So is Ben. He gets a chance to actually study the score and prepare. Ben approached me a few years ago, and we started talking about this thing, and he said, what should we pair it with? What are you thinking in terms of instrumentation? And I said, I'd like it to be symphonic, but not too big, and, let's get some wind players and brass players in there. And he said, I've always wanted to do Stravinsky's Pulcinella Suite. And I said, great. I love neoclassical Stravinsky, and as I did a little research, and I found out, this was sort of the birth of Stravinsky's neoclassical period. This is the project that made him, that kind of turned the light on for him and made him realize how much territory there was to be mined in looking backward over his shoulder and historically. And that's kind of the way I am anyway. I'm very much a traditionalist and dare to say innovate, but as I pursue my own path, I'm always... I never want to reject what's come before, so it seemed very natural to me, and I strove to write something that would be a good pair with the Stravinsky, and of course not to compete with it, but also it was a great opportunity to, this being my first kind of full-scale symphonic piece, to learn about more deeply and explore the tradition of the classical concerto, a three-movement piece. So that's what I have. It's a three-movement piece. There's a fast movement, and a slow movement, a fast movement. The third movement is a rondo. It's in rondo form. On the surface, it's very much like something that Mozart would have put forth. He would probably have done it in a week, but
And like Mozart, it's hot off the presses, so we can't even experience it on our airwaves yet.
No, that's the joy of a world premiere, isn't it?
We could sing a little bit for you.
So, Ben, did you have some influence in how this work took shape?
I did not. I just gave Evan the keys to the kingdom and said, go for it. We want something, 20, 25 minutes long, and we want it...
Well, that's ambitious in itself. Maybe he should have asked for something a little shorter.
And we need the music like 3 weeks before the concert. So. It's a very exciting project. I've been trying to lighten up the San Francisco Chamber Orchestra's classical programs, and not of course there are serious concerts, and we're trying to add some flavor and some delight to the program. Stravinsky is a wonderful pairing, I think, to Evan's neoclassical jazz concerto. They're both rooted in classical tradition for Evan, probably more Mozart. And for Stravinsky, it was this Baroque music that he thought was Pergolesi, but turned out not to be. But it's still delightful music that he based his Pulcinella Suite on. It's one of his happiest scores. It's just a music you can dance to all the way through. And I thought that Evan's jazz concerto by Evan on the lighter side would be a nice compliment.
Mm-hmm. When did you first encounter the artistry of Evan here?
Well, I moved to the Bay Area in the mid-90s, and I was working at the Crowden School, and Evan was very much involved over there. I saw some Turtle Island workshops, and I knew his wife was a wonderful violinist. And
Let me back up for the Turtle Island, but was that when Mads was involved, Mads Stolling?
I predated Mads, although we did overlap for 4 years, but I joined the group in 1997. So I was an old fart by the time we hired Mads 6 years later.
Nice. Yeah. Go on, Ben.
I've been a fan of Evan's since then. I really enjoy his playing. I've heard the Hot Jazz Club many times. And I basically wanted to be Django Reinhardt to his Stefan Grappelli.
There you go. Nice.
And so maybe as a conductor, we'll get a chance to do that.
Mm-hmm. So, Ben, you're also as involved with the San Francisco Chamber Orchestra in preparing these newsletters, the Simon Says newsletters, which are a lot of fun.
Well, thank you. Yeah. So again, we're trying to make classical music accessible to those who might be frightened by it, or they feel like you have to be educated in a certain way to enjoy a classical music concert. That's not true. We're trying to break down all the barriers for everyone's enjoyment of classical music, and we're starting with, I think, the most important one is that our concerts are all admission free. We're member supported, like KALW Radio, and we have grant. We have foundation support, and we have some angels. We do a gala, so we try to get our financing without having to sell tickets. And so far, that model is working really well for us.
Great, right. Well, since 1953, something's been going right with you guys.
Something's been going on right.
That's amazing. You are one of the ensembles that was unfortunately displaced in Berkeley. Tell us about how it's impacted you. I'm referring to the fire.
The fire at First Congregational Church. Well, we've been there for about 10 years, and it's one of the most beautiful venues in the Bay Area. We were, of course, shocked to... My daughter called me up at 3 o'clock on the Friday afternoon that the church was burning and said, turn on your television set. And
yikes.
It looked like the whole building was going up in flames. The good news is nobody was hurt, and the beautiful sanctuary was left relatively unscathed. The organ wasn't damaged, the beautiful Steinway piano. So we will have that beautiful concert hall back 6 months to a year. But for now, we and every other group has been displaced. We will be at St. John's Presbyterian Church, which is a beautiful venue on College Avenue, sort of between the campus and Ashby. And we were there many years ago. It's a little bit smaller venue, but the acoustics are lovely. The sight lines are beautiful. And when I told Evan, he said, I'm glad we're playing in Berkeley. I said, well, yes, we're going to play in Berkeley. That was never a question. And we have a lovely venue at St. John's Church.
Great. And were you still looking for a venue for the end of the year? Is that
true? Our New Year's Eve concert is our most popular. There are about 700 seats at First Congo, and we often will, and unfortunately, we can't often pack all the people that want to come to that concert. We often turn away hundreds of people with vouchers and promises to entertain them again in February if they want to come back. So we're looking for a venue of 700-800 seats in the Berkeley area, and we're still searching.
All right. Well, the sfco.org, if you've got a venue suggestion to pass on to Ben.
Or a very, very large living room.
Evan, what else is on your plate? You've been very busy traveling and touring.
That's right. Yeah. Well, as a member of the Hot Club of San Francisco, I've just kind of we've just launched our 2016-17 touring season kind of with a bang. We've been everywhere in the last 3 weeks, Florida and Arizona and North Carolina and Montana and Iowa just in the last couple of weeks. And we're also releasing, I think this week we're officially releasing our our 14th album, which is called John Paul, George, and Django, which is our treatment of, don't need to say this, but it's our treatment of Beatles tunes, as if Django had survived long enough to enjoy the Beatles, and we figure would have enjoyed them and probably would have played their music.
That's a double Django reference in this show.
Yes, right. Yeah, there's always room for Django, I suppose. Yeah. And so we're doing a series of CD release concerts around the Bay Area. These days we played at Yoshi's on Monday, and we're in San Rafael next week and Petaluma and various other places. So we're excited about that.
And where's home for you?
Mill Valley.
Oh, great. So you can stay nearby. That's good.
You're traveling next week. When are you practicing your violin concerto, Evan?
I get up early. I practice a little bit. I'll go to rehearsal, and then I'll have gigs in the evening. That's the life of a musician.
Okay, I won't be. I'm not worried.
Ben Simon, tell me a bit about the musicians that make up the chamber orchestra.
Well, we're very fortunate to have a very loyal and wonderful band of, I consider them the best freelance musicians in the Bay Area. Many of them play in what we call, fondly, the Freeway Philharmonic. But many of our players, such as Robin Sharp, teaches Stanford and plays chamber music. And it's we have a lot of ex-quartet players in our orchestra, which I love. I'm an ex-quartet player myself. So, Evan, if you ever want to join an orchestra, you're always welcome to jump into the SFCO.
I qualify, right?
You qualify as an ex-Turtle Islander. We have I think it's a remarkable band. My training is more as a violist and as a chamber musician, so I try to be a conductor who pulls the group together instead of sort of autocratically telling people what they're supposed to do. So we work together. I respect my musicians. We feel like we're all equals in the rehearsals, and it does feel like on our best days, it feels like a wonderful big string quartet rehearsal when we get together.
Nice, nice. We mentioned the end of the year big gala. What else is the chamber orchestra preparing for this season?
This is the fourth of four concerts. We have an all-Mozart program featuring the wonderful San Francisco pianist Robert Schwartz playing the Mozart D minor piano concerto number 20, one of my favorites. That's our New Year's Eve program. In February, we have a program based around some singers. Peter Joseph, who is a wonderful clarinet player and composer, has written a piece for the orchestra, and tenor Brian Thorsett, who Philharmonia Baroque fans or SFCO fans will remember Brian.
Yeah, sure.
And we're also featuring New York soprano Lara Nye in these beautiful Cantaloupe, the Songs of the Auvergne, which is one of my favorite classical pieces.
Amazing music.
And then we have a string orchestra. We're going to do Schubert's Death and the Maiden Quartet for string orchestra, which is going to be a fantastic exercise for the orchestra. Our fourth concert is something I've been wanting to do for forever, which is a music and humor program featuring the music of Peter Schickele and P.D.Q. Bach, Mozart's Musical Joke, Haydn's Joke Quartet. And I think we're going to transcribe a movement of P.D.Q. Bach's Concerto for Viola, Four Hands, and Harpsichord for viola and orchestra. Never before done. So that should be a lot of fun.
My gosh. And all the concerts are free, which is fantastic. TheSFCO.org for more information. Friday, they're at the Herbst Theater. Next Friday, the 28th, a 7:30 performance. On the Saturday, the 29th, at First United Methodist Church in Palo Alto. And then on Sunday, a matinee at 3 o'clock on the 30th at St. John's Presbyterian Church in Berkeley. Pergolesi's Concerto in G, four-string orchestra. Evan Price's premiere of the Concerto for Jazz, Violin, and Orchestra, an SFCO commission and world premiere, will be performed along with Stravinsky's Pulcinella Suite, which we'll hear a little bit of. Not you guys playing it, but just to usher you off to get listeners in the mood for some Pulcinella. Gentlemen, welcome. Thank you very much for coming in today, and we wish you some wonderful performances. And Evan, by all means, come on in again when you want to push something with the other quartet you're with.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for having us, David.
Of course. Touch of Pulcinella, Stravinsky, classical music-inspired Pulcinella Suite, written in 1920, part of the Jazz dell'Arte concert of the San Francisco Chamber Orchestra next weekend, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. It's Ben Simon as conductor with the world premiere of the Evan Price Concerto for Jazz, Violin, and Orchestra, with Evan performing as the jazz violinist. Information at thesfco.org. ODC celebrates 40 years of fine dance and educational events. I had the good fortune to talk with Christy Bolingbroke just the other day in this pre-recorded segment. Christy, welcome back to Open Air.
Hi, David. It's good to have you. Good to see you again.
Well, and so nice to be in your native space here at the ODC Theater.
Yes, yes, absolutely. Thank you for joining us.
Well, I'm so sorry I missed Tuesday's Performance Magazine. Tell me how that went.
It was fantastic. You know, ODC early on in 1976 to 81 first initiative was to publish a quarterly journal that looked at aesthetics and form. And so in looking at our 40-year retrospective, it was a wonderful opportunity to mine the format of a magazine and how would that look in performance. Not unlike a pop-up magazine or your own radio show, but to give space for dancers who use text, lots of oral histories that were then represented through performance, and also to read some of the original essays. So we had Hope Moore, who read Susan Sontag, which was such a treat.
Nice. And we got to think about that for a minute. 40 years. Something must be going right here at ODC. What's the secret?
Brenda would say something along the lines of perseverance, our founding artistic director, Brenda Way, and I think that that's certainly something to be said.
We should still mention is quite active in the organization.
Absolutely. Making work on the company, a real conspirator when it comes to curating, and I always appreciate being able to bounce ideas off of her and just tap into her mind. I think one of the other secrets is constantly being willing to evolve, to not necessarily reinvent oneself, but to adapt, to really look around and say, what are artists interested in doing? What do they need? How do we continue to grow with artistic ideas? How do we continue to build an audience for contemporary performance?
And in such a dance-rich environment that the San Francisco Bay Area is, you found a formula that seems to be thriving.
Yeah. I don't know if it's a formula as much, but our research really showed that to have such a space that's here to serve the community, that can be a place of what we're calling junction or nexus, that artists can come together, that can have a platform for dialogue, that you can see contemporary ballet one night and Buto the next week, is a rich place for good friction. And it also is a much needed space, given our role on the West Coast. We've played the American debut for Aiko and Koma when they first came over from Japan. We were one of the West Coast debuts for Bill T. Jones and Arnie Zane when they were first just performing together in the early 80s. So this has constantly been not only a resource for the very rich, prolific Bay Area dance community, but also a destination for so many artists who are trying to break in anywhere along the West Coast.
Well, speaking of space, for the last 7 years, you're now in this fantastic space here on 17th Street that not only offers a great main stage, but a secondary performing space, a cafe, and rehearsal studios.
Yes, yes. I mean, it is the fully realized. We like to say at ODC, we support every stage of the creative life cycle. And in addition to creative process, that this is a place for serious dancers, but also serious humans who enjoy a good coffee, who also care for their body and choose to live life and embody the spirit of San Francisco as well.
Well, speaking to the history of 40 years of ODC, we have to also mention that even prior to this renovated space on 17th Street, ODC was the first modern dance company in America to build its own home facility back in 1979.
Yes, yes. And actually, long before the tech booms and busts, this here at 17th and Shotwell was not ODC's first space, but they had been over on Mississippi Street. And as stories told in countless cities, artists move into a space that no one wants. They make it a great space. And then the landlords say, excellent, we would like to charge more rent. You can pay more or move out. And so that really is what primed the purchase of a building. It was after being displaced and being, really evicted. And I know that that's a rife topic right now in San Francisco, too. So we were still leading the charge even then, that the original collective members spread out across the city and found our building, which was a hardware store, an old hardware store at the time, here at 17th and Shotwell, and then have started to, purchase it then, which I think it was less than $200,000, if we can even think about housing prices. But that's the foresight and the vision that Brenda brought, being space-based.
And you also have the nearly adjacent space that has additional performance space and rehearsal studios and office space.
Yes, down at 351 Shotwell between 17th and 18th Street, which has allowed us to develop a campus atmosphere and be able to spread out as we've needed to, certainly for our youth and teen program, for offices, because now more than one, two, three people need to be here to run the space as well. But it's also allowed us to be extremely generous and inviting. We know that it is our responsibility as landlords ourselves, owners of space, that we need to remain accessible and available to artists, not just dance artists. We have theater companies that rent out studios and conference rooms, a lot of nonprofit organizations who just need meeting space for their board meetings. And that's the kind of community destination that isn't always just about performances, but being a community organizer.
Well, back to the tremendous celebrations around the 40th anniversary. Tonight, as well as last night with Deborah Slater, tonight with Keith Hennessy and Scott Wells, you're presenting ODC's signature events, ODC Theater Unplugged. Mm-hmm. So why is that your signature event, and what exactly happens at an Unplugged event?
Unplugs are something that are signature because our flagship company, ODC Dance, started this. And when I first got here, remarked to Brenda, I said, you know, other companies don't do this. And she said, oh, I thought we just had to. I said, no, there's such a generous spirit. It is work in process. It is a very raw, vulnerable place for an artist to be, to share their work that early on. And invite an audience in to then invite them and say, so what do you think? We're still figuring out the costumes. And it's also not just finished product. I liken the experience to when, if you remember in English or grammar classes growing up, we used to diagram sentences. So the real unplugged format is
Do they do that anymore?
I don't know. I know. What's writing sentences? We just text emoticons. But it's like diagramming a dance. This was the idea. We asked the artist to do this. The dancers came up with this option and option B. And then we decided, let's take option B and teach it to everyone. And so a couple of those things will be shown. And then the piece will be run in its order. So it gives you kind of a couple moments to recall as you're watching them in their context, but you got to understand their origin story.
Well, sharing of a different sort also goes on for this Saturday's and Sunday's wrecking sessions. What is a wrecking session?
Mm-hmm. Wrecking was originated by an East Coast choreographer, Susan Rethorst, and I guess in layman's terms, or layman as far as the Bay Area is concerned, it's like having your dance hacked, right? Instead of hacking my website or hacking my code, to say, here's the vocabulary that I've created in a world that I consider to be a complete piece, and then being really open and vulnerable again to asking another artist who can then manipulate that, who could edit. They can't add additional, it's not like, oh, I'm going to come in and create new, you know, eight counts and teach your dancers.
Nor is it a specific critique.
No, it's not a specific critique. It's an opportunity for another choreographic eye to reveal something about the habits of the dance to the original choreographer. So if they instead, in one section, ask the performers to say, I want you to do that as small as possible and introduce stillness in some ways, then the original choreographer can see their own work through another lens. And, you know, we talk about critique a lot of times. Dance writing is very important to us, too, and language. We love language around here. But at the end of the day, we speak dance and movement first. So sometimes the best way to be shown something would be through the movement itself in a different light.
Backing up to Friday, a dance party. How is this a participatory dance party?
Absolutely. Part fundraiser and part a moment as a red prom. We went with red as a theme for 40 years because we, in a very deep Googling research, discovered that if you have a 40th anniversary, it's typical to give rubies. ODC Red also resonates with us. So we went with a red prom to, you know, be able to have a moment that we could all celebrate. Dance is what we do. There aren't any, you know, official performances. It is a space to gather. People will be able to have access to our museum-style installations that are upstairs in the building. It's an open bar, $40 in advance. I mean, how can you go wrong? And because of its proximity to Halloween, we encourage people to dress up as much or as little as they would like. That's usually not a problem in San Francisco.
Preferably something red.
Preferably something red. There are a lot of different gradients of red.
And then, you know, the celebration continues through next weekend, the 28th through the 30th. Some very special events happening on that final weekend. Share some of the details about them.
Sure. We are co-presenting the home season for Nicole Claymoon's Embodiment Project, a new production of hers called Seed Language. Nicole is a fantastic documentary dance theater maker who really focuses on a street dance aesthetic. Usually sells out, just an amazing new young artist that we're very excited to support. As one of our resident artists, that felt very right to include as a part of the 40th anniversary, because residency, the question of space, who has access to space, who can make a home here, has been such a big piece of our work. And we host a cohort of four resident artists for a period of 3 years. That's the current iteration of the residency program. And we can really see where their artistic and infrastructural growth evolves over that time, too.
Very linked to contemporary events.
Yes, yes. She is specifically, you know, doing a work inspired and responding to state violence and using oral histories from some of the original leaders in Black Lives Matter and the Black Panthers, and always packs a real punch in her work in a always surprising way, too, because you think you're coming to a dance show and it's actually going to change how you see the world you live in.
Well, I was kind of surprised to read about your having a successor. Julie Potter has been named ODC's theater director. Tell us about Julie.
Julie joins us from YBCA. She had worked in the performance and pedagogy department at the Yerba Buena Center for the Arts. Is an old friend, although we're both not that old, and a longtime friend. And I think a wonderful successor and choice in terms of a shared ethos. And we're very similar, but also different. And that's part of the evolution of ODC Theater, is always knowing how to change and adapt.
I can't imagine you're just, you know, closing the door and giving the keys away. What are your plans with ODC or beyond?
So I have been in a state of transition for 2 months now. I've accepted a brand new position in Ohio, where I'll be establishing a brand new National Center for Choreography, and I'm the executive artistic director, so it's a startup. It'll be the second of its kind in the country, and so I'm like to tell people I'm not going away. I'm going national. Dance will still be at the focal point, and ODC most definitely a satellite and close to my heart.
Well, back to ODC's roots in Ohio. Christy, thanks so much for taking some time with us. ODC has been so enriched by your presence, and I'm sure we'll see you around the campus more still.
Thank you, David.
Information about all things ODC and the remaining celebratory 40th anniversary events is at their website, odcdance.org.
Fly me to the moon, let me play among the stars, and let me see what spring is like on Jupiter and Mars. In other words, hold my hand. In other words, baby, kiss me. Fill my heart with song and let me sing forevermore. You are all I long for, all I worship and adore. In other words, please be true. In other words, I love you.
Appropriate music indeed to introduce this next segment with regular contributor Peter Robinson, who's going to talk about airports and things one can do when one is flying the friendly skies. Peter, welcome back to Open Air.
Hi, David. Good to be here.
And I wish we had talked about this earlier in the month, as I could have used some advice prior to my trip to England. We're airing this while you are, in fact.
I am. When I think about
across the pond.
When I think about come fly with me, I always fly with a book. And I find that with all the distractions, particularly on a transatlantic flight, which can take sometimes 12 or even 13 hours, depending on the delays, you then have to arrive 2 hours ahead of time at the airport for an international flight. So before looking at what I call airport reading, I have had some thoughts about the three major Bay Area airports themselves. And there are choices to be made. For example, if you go over to the Oakland airport and it's foggy in San Francisco, there's a good chance Oakland, your flight will get out on time. They have a much lower fog density than they do at SFO. And unless you're living in South San Francisco, the trip down to San Jose usually makes it a much too longer day, given the fact you've got to be there 2 hours before.
Optimally, but, of course, when you're flying transatlantically, you want to do a nonstop, instead of having to deal with further delays in other airports.
That's right. And look at the jargon. A direct flight doesn't mean a nonstop flight. So we have all sorts of words, particularly with seating. You can get legroom seats. You can get knees-in-your-face seats.
Anything for a price is the way I like to look at it.
That's what they charge. They actually charge you to breathe nowadays once you're on board.
Well, I was astonished by the fact that not only did I have to pay for my airline ticket, but then they said you can, of course, be seated once you arrive at the airport, which means you're going to be stuck in a middle seat or whatever, or you can pay X dollars to choose your seat now. I was like, wait a minute, you just charged me how many, hundreds and hundreds of dollars for the seat, for the flight, and now you're going to charge me for the seat as well.
Oh, no. There's no reprieve, even for the good.
So onward to suggested material for that flight.
But quickly about San Francisco Airport, I was delighted to see that in Publishers Weekly, they've actually rated SFO, San Francisco Main Airport, as the best place for intelligent bookshops or bookstores. And I mention this because Books, Inc. has two different outlets, one in Terminal 2, the other in Terminal 3 in the International. Books, Inc., of course, is a local bookstore here. There are 9 neighborhood bookstores in San Francisco. And I think they've gone a long way to, when I say upgrade airport reading. So if you are arriving ahead of time, you're wanting to walk around and browse, this is actually a good bookshop to browse in as you wait for those 2 hours before you finally end up, if you're lucky and everything's on time, on your seat. It's called the Compass Rose, Terminal 2. The other thing I think worth mentioning is at the International Airport now in San Francisco, they do have a museum, and it's the Air Museum. It's currently got quite an interesting, I'm going to call it a costume show, because it's all the different uniforms that have been used or worn by airport personnel. And today in the world of political correctness, you want to get the title right. Attendance has replaced stewards and stewardesses, and one couldn't get away with it nowadays, but they used to call them dolly trolleys as they came down the aisles. But we can't do that anymore, and that's a good step forward, and so there we are. So what is the airport novel? And believe it or not, it is a genre which has actually been defined by publishers. It often falls into crime fiction, detective fiction, historical romance, spy fiction, or thrillers. But gradually, particularly in the Bay Area, as the sales in airport bookstores has begun to increase, which I think is interesting because you often see a lot of people with Kindles on board reading, but there is something to be said for holding the book in your hand on the plane, and it gives you a sense of being engaged and being involved, particularly with all the distractions, and sometimes, let's get it right, the boredom that flying can induce. My choice, and this is just my choice for this upcoming flight, I'm rereading one book because I actually had it yellow marked from last year, and it's called Reclaiming Conversation, The Power of Talk in a Digital Age. It's by Sherry Turkle, and I think this again reminds me what conversation can do, and particularly if you listen to the radio, if you work in radio and you listen to KLW, some of the great things that happen here is that people talk to each other. And I think the power of conversation, or the power of talk in the digital age, is one of those books that gets you to, for a second, put aside your laptop, put aside your cell phone, and actually speak to a friend. And this is a book which speaks to me. So I'm going to be reading that on my trip to the UK. The second is a choice by a favourite author of mine, Ben McIntyre. He's a regular feature writer for the Times newspaper in London. And his new book is called Rogue Heroes. It's the history of the SAS. That's the special air service forces, which started in the Desert Campaign in the 1940s. And I think it's important today because what the group did was become commandos. And this is not only interesting history, but all the later special forces, whether it's Delta Force in this country, even some of the special forces used both by the Israeli Defense and some of the special units that we actually hear actively engaged in Syria today are based on these rogue heroes which started their lives in 1940. Ben McIntyre wrote Agent Zigzag, great story, a spy story there. And again, he is not only a good historian, he's a good storyteller. And I think he brings these two elements together. And my last choice, which I'm bringing, is not a printed book, it is an audio book. And again, if you're sitting on an aeroplane seat and you're halfway between awake and sleep, sometimes hearing a book, hearing an audio book read well, can be both engaging of the mind, but also therapeutic. It can slowly take you into that jet lag that you're going to hit when you change the clocks, when in my case I arrive at the UK. So my choice is the new John le Carré biography. He's the reader himself, and this is a excellent story. It's called The Pigeon Tunnel, and he reflects on his life. It's a memoir peppered with interesting incidents, and as I say, he has just the right voice if you're looking, and I used to say, as the BBC used to call it, a book at bedtime. He is somebody who can gently, but not send you to sleep. He can keep you awake, but make sleep super happenings afterwards. So these are just some of the choices. They're slightly different to the published definition of the airport novel, but if you are looking for something to do and you arrive these 2 hours early at SFO, put your nose around the Compass Rose, which is a very interesting bookstore. It's part of the Books Inc., and maybe that'll make that wait just a little more entertaining.
Thanks, Peter, as always, and bon voyage to you as you return to England for a couple of weeks.
It's a jolly old, as we'll see what happens there. And they don't say God save the Queen anymore. They say Britannia waives the rules, because now Brexit is on its way.
Indeed. Thanks, Peter. And that's Open Air for this Thursday, October 20th. Neil Swinkles produces the show. You can send segment ideas to me at my website or through email, david@kalw.org. And a reminder that all of our shows are archived at KALW's website, kalw.org. Thanks for listening.